Scott?
Hello.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're trying to put all your words from testimony together, it can be pretty tough to try to get all that emotion out. And so, with Gary's careful coaching, I'm gonna do mine and interpretive dance. Hey, why are you laughing? Come on. You would have taught me in dance, right, Gary? I will tell you my favorite joke, though. I can't stop. So, a priest, a doctor, and an engineer are playing golf. And there's a foursome in front of them that's going so slow, and they're super irritated. And so they call the marshal over, and they say, "Hey, what's going on with these guys? Can you hurry them up or whatever?" And the marshal's like, "No, those are the four blind firemen that lost their eyesight saving our clubhouse last year. So we let them play whenever they want. You're going to have to be patient." Well, the doctor immediately felt bad and said, "I'm going to go talk to some of my colleagues, you know, see if we can get some help for them." The priest said, "You know what? I'm going to go to my congregation. I'm going to, you know, see if I can get some donations, put them on the prayer list." The engineer, he's looking down the fairway, just analyzing them, and he's like, kind of finally looks over at the marshal. He's like, "Why can't these guys play at night?" Yeah, so as Gary said, I do work in the oil and gas business by trade. I'm more of a project manager anymore. Most folks tell me I don't like act like an engineer. That's a huge compliment. And for my real job, I've been married 20 years. I have two beautiful teenage daughters, a 12-year-old son. Very blessed. Very busy and very proud of all of them. One thing to know about me right up front is that wind. How can I fix that?
Engineer.
So one thing to know about me right up front is I was born with a 40 to 50% hearing loss. And I didn't have hearing aids growing up, and so I had to learn the world and perceive the world much differently than most. I communicate intuitively with a lot of nonverbal Bible or body language. I read lips. It's easy for me to pick up on a vibe from someone, and even from a long distance. And I think that's kind of a cool gift to have, honestly. But it's a much different world that I perceive than most. Now I could spend the whole day here telling you about my childhood, and it's a pretty target-rich environment, but for the sake of time, I'm going to just skim through it. I was born in Lubbock. My parents were 19 years old when they had me. They were just kids figuring life out themselves. They divorced when I was a toddler, and the next 6 or 7 years of my life were pretty chaotic. We were poor. We lived in apartments, trailers. And I bet you over that period of time, I lived in 10 different places, sometimes with my mom, sometimes with my dad, grandparents, aunts, and uncles. And my family was far from perfect. And I can assure you that during this time, I learned about all the good stuff. I learned about drugs, alcohol, divorce, remarriage, re-divorce. I learned about police. I learned about fighting. Truly a lot of stuff. However, I'll say this, like, through the grace of God, I'm very glad for those experiences. Like, I wasn't, and one of the reasons is I wasn't curious or excited about any of that growing up. You know, sometimes if you're sheltered, you feel a little excited about the idea of going and partying or something. I'd already seen it. I'd already lived through it. And so when it came to drugs and alcohol, it wasn't really a temptation for me. But I did, you know, still party a little bit, but it wasn't a big curiosity, and so I attribute that to my childhood. And I'm very grateful for my family because despite how messy it was during that time, they were always very loving to me. And they always told me they loved me. And they were very humble and honest about their own mistakes and would tell me so. My family, and especially my mom, would speak a lot of truth into me. She would say things like, "Chad, you're better than this. You're going to break the cycle of poverty. You're going to go to school. You're going to do better." And so when you're in that period of chaos, those words are super powerful for a kid to hear. And so at 10 years old, things stabilized a bit for me. My mom remarried a great man named Mark, and they had two sons. And so now I had two brothers. And I was a typical stepkid for a bit. I was a complete pain. But Mark, he chose us. He chose me. And he was just an amazing stepfather of me. But still, there was this byproduct of that instability. And for as long as I can recall, I felt like my job was to not cause problems. Don't ask for anything and don't cost any money. You know? And so I didn't. And so through that, I became a bit of a people pleaser. And I became very self-reliant and independent through that. And I'll share a quick story to illustrate this. When I was 13, I'm just 1 year older than my youngest son, the principal called me to the office, and my mom was there. And I was like, oh man, what did I do now, right? And the principal just cut straight to the chase. He said, Chad, your dad's been shot. He's in ICU. We do not know the status, but go with your mom and go figure it out. And so, obviously, tons of questions. I'm quite scared and not sure what's going on. And at this time, my dad was single, and you know, I would go and visit him every other weekend, and he always had different women around. It was nothing for me to wake up on a Saturday morning and there would be a new woman in the house, and a lot of them were covered in glitter, if you know what I mean. So I really didn't know if he was alone in the hospital or not. And so, well, on the drive up there, you know, my mom and him did not keep in touch much. And so we're driving to the hospital, and she's doing what moms do. She's like, I'm going to go in there with you, Chad. Don't worry about all this. Trying to hype me up. But however, the only thing I was considering was I knew that her and my dad were divorced. They weren't close. And so I didn't want her seeing the awkwardness. I didn't want her to experience the awkwardness of going into a hotel or this hospital room with her ex-husband with some who knows who's going to be there. And plus, I was really concerned with her having the two toddlers at home. I just, that was kind of pulling on me that she had that responsibility. And I was like, no, Mom, I can handle this. So here I am. I'm 13 years old. I just go into the hospital alone. I figure out where my gunshot dad is. I find out he's by himself, and I'm the very first one there. And it's a bizarre scene, right? Like, you're going in there, and the nurses, they're confused. Like, why is this kid here instead of some adults? But that's just the way I was and the way life was. And the good news is that my dad lived, and after several surgeries, went on to recover about a year later. I witnessed a really physically strong man recover through some stuff, tough things. But the bad news is he really started drinking after this and went on to a lifelong battle of alcoholism. And so on that topic, I did the math, and from my grandparents' generation down, one out of three people in my family are addicts. Both alcohol and drugs. Seven have been hospitalized, four have died, one shot himself, and one is currently in the federal pen, which is my youngest brother. He's in there for drugs. And so I'm very familiar with the subject, and I don't have time to go into how all those experiences shaped my life, but an interesting thing for me that I've slowly started to learn about dealing with family members who are addicts is it's a lot like you just lose them. It's almost like they die. Because you have to go through those same steps. You're going through the steps of emotion like denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, apathy. And finally, you end up getting empathy for these people. And it's just a very hard thing. Back on track, my childhood experiences made me, again, very self-reliant and a bit controlling. And not controlling in the way that I had to have my way all the time. I was controlling in that I didn't want drama. And so my life choices would create less drama. That's how it manifested itself in my life. I went through high school. I did all the right things. I was popular. I had girlfriends. I played baseball. I was on the wrestling team. I had straight A's. And I still, you know, had fun. I went to all the parties and keg parties, all that stuff. My parents, you know, they couldn't pay for a car or college for me, so I figured out a way to do that. I did really well in college. Again, I had a lot of fun, but I managed to get my mechanical engineering degree, and I became the first in my family to graduate college. Got a good job, moved off to the big city, met my wife, Christy. I was checking all the boxes of life. And up to this time, I went to church occasionally, you know, mainly to make my grandma happy. I went on Christmas and Easter, and I called myself a Creaster, Christmas and Easter, right? However, when we had our first child, Avery, something really special happened. I felt this incredible tug from the Lord to go back to church, and there were all kinds of people coming into my life, coworkers, neighbors, family, friends. I was getting pulled from so many directions, looking and back. You know, like there were so many people after that for me. Very thankful. So got plugged into church. And although I never had one of those ultra revival emotional moments, it was more of a slow fade for me. At this point in my life, I truly did believe that Jesus Christ freely gave saving grace. He was crucified, died on that cross, and was resurrected 3 days later. I truly believed it at this point in my life. And it was a great season of growth. But looking back now, again, the theme was the same. I was checking the boxes, which is, you know, going to an hour of church on Sunday and doing some Bible studies. I'm really good at controlling the steps and doing the work. And the funny thing about control is you think you have it until you don't, right? So 2015, that's a year that really changed me. Within the span of a few months, and I'm talking like 4 months, my grandfather, my dad, and my stepdad, Mark, all died suddenly and unexpectedly. And these men were so important to me. I love them tremendously. They poured a lot into me, and it was just so hard. My dad was only 58, Mark, he was just 52. And so they meant so much to me, invested so much time. Three biggest father figures in my life gone. And I fell into what I can do well. I went turbo mode. I took on all the estate tasks for the family. I tried to be all things to all people. I tried to joke around while I was at it. I thought I needed to go through it to get through it, if that makes sense. Just get through it. But when night came, I couldn't sleep. I was experiencing something very new to me. I started to feel this extreme guilt of not being there for my widowed mom. I was still trying to be great at my wife, my work, my family, my social life, being part of the church. The basic cycle for me during this was, over the next couple years, is I would hammer at everything I needed to do, and then I would crash of exhaustion, almost to the point of being sick. And I was just spinning so many plates, and I found myself being very sad about all kinds of other things too, like my children just getting older. And I found myself becoming very indecisive and just toiling over decisions I used to could just make in my sleep. And instead, I'm just getting overly anxious about all this stuff. And I couldn't figure out what's going on inside my head. And so I eventually went to a counselor a couple times, and this was a very hard thing for me to do. I don't know why it was so hard, but it was. And I did learn some things. I learned that this busyness that I was doing was just avoidance, and it was delaying the grieving and healing that I needed to do. And I also learned there's a saying that's so true, that if you're living in the past, you're going to feel depressed. And if you're living in the future, you're going to feel anxious. So you need to live in the present, right? It's very easier said than done, right? So John 14, 15 through 17 says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper to be with you forever. Even the Spirit of truth whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him, for he dwells with you and will be with you." Like, what is a helper? I didn't understand what that meant. I liked the idea. What is this helper? So little by little, over the next few years, my self-reliance, my old, you know, system of living, if you will, was getting chipped away at. And this illusion of control that I had was being broken down. And slowly it was being replaced with some peace and perhaps a little bit of character, I hope. And I was noticing more awareness of the joys and positives. I was very aware of all those folks out there loving on us, and relationships became a big priority for me. In 2021, we found out my wife Christy had cancer in her neck. And I can only describe that news of how it made me feel physically right then. I had this narrowing of the vision. I have this flush of heat in my neck and this slight buzzing sound. And I was somewhat listening to the doctor. But I can only attribute it to my helper promised in John 14. I had some peace, and I just felt a little bit of calmness set in. just a bit. And I would occasionally still get freaked out, but overall, the calmness remained over the next few weeks of these endless doctor's appointments. Her first surgery at MD Anderson was when the world was in full-on COVID lockdown. Hardly anyone could go into the hospital. You know, limited access. They're scanning your foreheads to go in. The halls are empty. It just had this really ominous feel to the whole hospital complex, a very alone feel. I remember the surgery started in the afternoon in the waiting room at MD Anderson. They have this scrolling screen of the patients in surgery, and it says, you know, prep, you know, waiting, surgery in progress, recovery, all done. And I kept watching that screen as dozens of others kept finishing up, and then well past the time she was supposed to finish, there was only one name up there, and that was my wife. It was just flashing at me for hours. Everybody else was done but her. Just her name. So 7 hours later, and I really don't know the time, but it was late at night, the doctor came in, and I could tell he was exhausted. Remember, I have that skill of reading people's body language, and it was painfully obvious to me that things weren't going well. And he and I were the only people in this giant dark waiting room, and he tells me that her cancer is way more spread than anticipated, and proceeds to give me two options, neither of which I liked. And I felt that same buzzing and flush of heat in my neck, and I just had this horrific mental image of her on that operating table with her neck open, and it was just heartbreaking to me, and I had to make that hard decision on the spot. And so hurting, I hit my knees, and I prayed for her, the doctors. It felt very real. It was the most real prayer I've ever said. And I finally truly surrendered in that moment, and this supernatural calmness set in, and right then, within seconds, I started receiving all these texts from people that they didn't know the timing, but they started pouring in. It was amazing, and they were encouraging text messages. And so the hospital wouldn't let me stay the night because it was in COVID, and so well past midnight, I had to leave her there all alone, and that's very hard to leave your wife behind in that situation. I remember walking down those empty hallways and that weird, sterile smell of the hospital, and the streets were empty. It wasn't comfortable at all, but I had finally accepted my helper. So fast forward to today, 5 years later, Christy, she still has cancer, and we're still in that waiting game. And the medications have been hard on her. This lingering, you know, kind of unsolved, uncontrollable situation has taken its toll. There's no way I could have done this alone. And I want to be clear, I'm not sharing these stories to make you sad or sympathy. In fact, it's hard for me to share this stuff. I don't want to put any burden on anyone. I'm sharing it because I'm stronger for that. And I'm glad to have had this stuff going on. And Christy, she's stronger today than she has been in years, y'all. She's been down, up and down the stairs a lot, floated the river twice this week. That's awesome. 2 Timothy 2:3 says, share in suffering as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. That's pretty clear to me. Soldiers are trained to suffer pain, go into enemy territory, and survive. Soldiers are there to serve others. And pain and suffering is interesting to me. It's kind of funny to me now. When it comes to physical pain and suffering, like exercise, because I want to look better or be more competitive, I embrace that really hard. But when it comes to that emotional and spiritual pain, which is also a form of exercise, if you will, I avoid that. But that pain is so, or that growth that you experience from that is so permanent and strong and encouraging. So now, through no effort of my own, I believe God is teaching me to stand in these places of pain, and instead of just absorbing it, which I failed miserably at, I can give it back over to Him, and He'll be the ultimate grade for that pain. And, you know, whether it's dealing with the aftermath of, you know, childhood divorce, a gunshot dad, drug addicted family members, losing fathers, a brother in the federal pen, or even supporting a spouse that has cancer, I still don't like the pain. I've learned to appreciate the gain perspective, being able to relate to others. And the things that used to be big now seem a lot smaller. And that's powerful. So that's all I got. Thank you for listening.